And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
As we head into the holiday season, and thoughts of family and friends, traditions and ancient rites and rituals meander in and out of our thoughts, something happens. We feel a richness that sometimes it's hard to find. Remembering life has that effect, and today we take a look at a life well lived as we go in depth with one of the world's greatest communicators, thinkers, and spirits. Today, we take a walk in the wild mind of Dr. David Suzuki. When your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Last week, as we spent time with our families, it may have become obvious to many of us that each generation has its own unique worldview. Those ancient elders reminisce endlessly of a time before there were cars, living through the Great Depression. They were the fathers and mothers of the baby boomer generation, which had its first exposure to TV, rock and roll, and the Vietnam War. The S-Geners, passé now, were post-war kids growing up on recycling, multiple families, and pre-punk. And the children we see today, lashed into their SUVs, driven by safety-conscious moms and dads, live in their rooms to provide them with enough entertainment to keep them away from all the dangers that lurk in their backyards and neighborhoods. There's something awkward and painful about how each generation deals with the changes, each one hearkening back to a time when it was definitely better, when the pace was slower, when community was real, when freedom meant wandering off on one's own to explore and discover, when kids played in the woods or came home wet from plunging their way through a creek. But you see, those are my memories, which I express with a sense of loss for the kids of today. But they don't long for such, for they're being shaped by their own fond memories of the dread of having to decide in favor of the new Xbox 360, PlayStation 3, or Wii to arrive, or the fear of riding in a small car compared to the safe feeling of a giant SUV, or the freedom of surfing the web and seeing almost everything before parental controls actually started working. And they, too, will see the loss and express it to their children when the longing of the ancient elders exists no more. Some amongst us have witnessed it all, and that perhaps is the subtext to a theme of change, for the onward press towards globalization just may have worked too well, having tied us all into a digitalized, mercantile global community destined to consume ourselves out of house and home. Translation, our place on earth. Today, we dedicate this entire show to the breadth and wisdom of Dr. David Suzuki, who has witnessed so much as he looks back on his life of 70 years as one of the world's most fascinating, energizing, and enlightening spokesmen for life in all of its wondrous diversity. We begin our conversation following the news, and it continues through segments 2 and 3. So settle in for our grand perspective on life and wonder, past, present, and future. But first, the news. The scientist who applied the term Gaia to the Earth in order to help make the point that the entire Earth is a living system recently suggested that the Earth is beginning to suffer the effects of a fever, otherwise known as global warming. And just as human species must maintain a constant temperature of 98.6 degrees, and only a 1 to 3 degree change can indicate distress, while a 6 to 8 degree rise can result in death, similarly he suggests a comparison can be made to Gaia, and he suggests that a fevered earth could result in a much lower capacity to sustain life. James Lovelock, who has a unique capacity to upset just about everyone at some time or another, upsetting climate scientists with his Gaia theory and pushing many environmentalists with his backing nuclear power, also suggested that although we are headed into a fevered condition, this does not mean that measures could not be taken to decelerate the otherwise inevitable rise in temperatures, which he predicts to be as much as 8 degrees centigrade during this century, and which he also predicts could cause the Earth's living systems to decrease to one-tenth its current 6 billion human population figure. He sees us headed towards a seriously ill living Earth if CO2 emissions are not addressed, particularly as China and India add coal plants to their energy arsenals each week. He sees a chronic dilemma, as these developing countries have almost no choice about adding power to support their adoption of the modern age, adding that if either suddenly decided to stop their carbon-fueled development to lift their billions of people out of poverty, they would face revolution. Yet if they continue, rising CO2 and temperatures could kill off plants and produce famine. India is home to half the world's tiger population, which is now under severe threat from the impetus for poachers to kill the animals to sell to illegal wildlife traders. Poor forest dwellers, who share lands within the 28 tiger reserves in India, are often paid as little as $5 for each tiger killed, the skin of which will fetch as much as $20,000 in the international market. India, which was home to an estimated 40,000 tigers, now finds itself the keepers of as few as 1,200 tigers, or as many as 3,700, wildlife experts agree. Members of the wildlife conservation communities around the world are exploring ways to involve local people living in forest conservation areas in campaigns which result in preservation of these highly complex and severely threatened species. In recent months, India passed new legislation aimed at tackling the tiger crisis, providing a National Tiger Conservation Authority and a Wildlife Crime Bureau to investigate poaching and curbing of illegal trade in wildlife parts. Scientists have once again announced new evidence that may suggest that humpback whale species may share specific brain cells that are found only in the more intelligent animals, including humans, great apes, and other cetaceans such as dolphins. Scientists therefore surmise that such humpbacks are more intelligent than they have been given credit for, as the existence of spindle neurons appears to be associated with higher levels of cognition. The presence of such spindle neurons. The presence of such spindle neurons brings science one tiny step farther in acknowledging that animals indeed may have the capacity to form complex behaviors. Meanwhile, whales continue to welcome human interactions, perform in water spectacles loved by millions around the world, star in movies that become box office blockbusters, and attempt to get the attention of scientists who keep dissecting whale brains to discover once and forever whether these animals show rudimentary intelligence. Scientists have announced that male birds, which rely on a spectrum of display and behavioral cues to indicate their virility and thus mate ability, indeed exhibit much more vibrant colors in direct relationship to their testosterone levels. Thus, brightly colored males suggest a healthier bird. Sick male birds often lose their vibrancy of their colorations and thus exhibit less desirability to potential female mates. Associated with color and testosterone levels are carotenoid levels, which create the palette of colors which birds acquire from eating colorful berries and insects. Unfortunately, higher levels of testosterone often result in a diminished immune system. However, carotenoids serve as excellent antioxidants which naturally bolster the immune system. Therefore, male birds high in testosterone and high in carotenoids have the best of all worlds as their vigor is increased, their immune systems are strong, and their coloration is terrific, and therefore so is their sex life. Human males suffering from a less than satisfactory sex life just may consider a diet of berries and insects. It just may spell the difference. And for the first time, snow leopards in Pakistan are being studied with the aid of a satellite collar, which should help in learning about the elusive animal's behaviors. Snow leopards, which inhabit the high mountains of Central Asia, including Pakistan, Afghanistan, China, and India, are finding themselves increasingly in competition for food with the encroaching human populations. They are also increasingly being killed, as their bones are a component in various traditional Chinese medical treatments. With estimates of between 3,500 and 7,000 snow leopards left in the world, conservationists hope the tracking information will help understand the complex movements and behaviors of these animals before their survival reaches the turning point. The World Wildlife Fund, Pakistan, is sponsoring the studies. For further information, visit their website at www.wwf.org. And that's the news. As someone who has spent his life in relationship with nature, it's true, nature to me is like a lover and a good friend. Anyway, I've come to the realization that there are people who get nature and people who don't. It's no grand realization, and I sometimes realize there's nothing we can really do about it, although so many of us keep trying. Is this love affair with nature and wonder innate? Many would suggest we're born with it. I tend to agree. So what happens to those who walk away from the wild, who see the meaning of life locked in the cities and media and glimmer of the grand consumerists? What happened to that innate love of nature? Today, we explore the life of someone who truly gets it. And it has shaped his life in everything he does, in every thought he thinks, and in every word he speaks. Dr. David Suzuki was trained as a geneticist, but quickly found an audience for his passionate understanding of the big picture, particularly humans and animals and rivers and power, which resulted in his award-winning PBS series, The Nature of Things. He has authored over 40 books, including The Sacred Balance, which should serve as perhaps the most elegant way of describing how he sees and how he feels about our time, now, and perhaps forever, or not. So please give the rest of this show your best, because you and everyone you know deserve it. So now, we go in depth with Dr. David Suzuki. I have an extraordinary personal joy in talking with the guest who is about to join us on the Wild Side News here for reasons that will become apparent, I hope, in this discussion. Joining us now from Portland, where he's traveling and helping to talk about many things, but including his new book, David Suzuki, the Autobiography, is Dr. David Suzuki. David, welcome to the Wild Side News.
The pleasure's all mine. Thanks for having me.
You have had an enormous influence on the planet in a lot of different ways, and I really think it just grew as part of your spirit, just who you were and how you grew up. And what I'd like to do in today's conversation, which is going to be extensive, is to, first of all, find the roots of that. One has to wonder why you had this particular fascination with the Earth and how that affected you, and we're ultimately going to end up with, so therefore, what about the future? And again, the opportunity for people to appreciate things as we were very fortunate to appreciate things.
Yeah, so I'd like, you know, I often get parents saying, now, what was it that was important in your life? How come you became this crusader for the environment? I want my kids to grow up just like you. And I'm saying, no, you don't. I'm just the result of a crazy set of circumstances that I hope never happen again. Certainly for me, being born a third-generation Canadian in British Columbia, and then having Pearl Harbor happen, Pearl Harbor really was the definitive event in my life that shaped me, both in terms of the drives that I have and in all of the hang-ups that I have as well are stem from that. You know, being growing up in Vancouver, while growing up to till I was six, as a carefree boy who never thought really much about being different from my neighbors, and then suddenly being told, you're an enemy, you can't be trusted, and you sure as hell don't have any rights of citizenship, even though you and your mom and dad are all born here. We're going to throw you in a camp and keep you chained away for imprisoned for the war and then kick you out of the province. That had a very, very big impact on shaping the person that I became.
And it obviously influenced everything you did, as you say, from that point forward. Let's start out with the boy prior to becoming the enemy, because I think that's where the real story begins.
Yep.
I see this image, and I kind of see this image of North America, and then it's like with the Google Earth now, I can kind of zoom in.
Yep.
And I go to some little tiny spot, some little spot in British Columbia, and that's where you started out.
That's right.
And
what a wonderful place to grow up as a boy, as I'm sure it was all throughout small town North America.
It's exactly right.
Vancouver in 1936 was a small city. I don't know what the population was, but it's nothing like the Vancouver of 2 million people today. And, you know, in 1936 when I was born, there were still dozens and dozens of streams and creeks that ran out of the city that had salmon runs in them. In 1900, there were 52 distinct salmon rivers and creeks in Vancouver. By the year 2000, there was only one. So the boy, when I was growing up, I mean, I could go down right in our neighborhood in the outskirts of Vancouver and catch trout. I could catch salmon. I'd go with my father and catch sturgeon in the Fraser River and halibut off what is now Spanish Banks, a big swimming area, or catch sea-run cutthroat trout right around Stanley Park, our great park in the middle of the city. That's the world that I grew up in as a boy, and it was a magical, magical place. And those early experiences really shaped me in terms of the things that bring me joy and the things that I find worth fighting for. And I think that's the way it was all across North America. In rural North America, there were still hundreds and hundreds of small towns that were flourishing, that were little vital communities of maybe 200, 500 people that became the hub of big farming country. I find all throughout the prairies in Canada, there are the derelict remnants of what used to be a whole series of towns spread all across the prairies of Canada. That's the way the world was back then.
And it was very connected and integrated with the world, the earth.
Of course.
And nature.
That
was the wonder.
You can't grow up in a rural setting or a small town setting without being aware of insects, about the importance of weather and encountering ditches and creeks and ponds. And I mean, I think that kids still had a very deep connection with the natural world. We didn't have television back then. We didn't have computers or anything to distract us. We had to get out and play. You know, I can remember when I was a boy, usually around 5:30, 6, that back doors would start opening and moms would start yelling, "Mary, David, come on in, it's dinner time." And we'd come out of the, you know, the little woodlot in the back or a ditch or playing out in the open fields, because, of course, back then there was no television, there were no computers to tie us up, and we were out playing. That's what we had to do, and we'd be out there whether it was raining or sunny. It didn't matter. We were out there, and I think that that's a huge difference that's happened now. We tend to separate ourselves and closet ourselves away in a man-made world. I always felt eternally grateful to my father because his mom and dad had emigrated to Canada early in the 1900s, and coming from Japan as immigrants, their whole focus was on making money and security. And my dad was the eldest in the family, and they taught him over and over, you've got to work hard and make money, 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 money. And I used to call my dad a mutant. I said, "Dad, how come you were such a mutant? Because you didn't listen to what your parents were saying. I mean, my dad always believed you had to work hard to make money for the necessities in life. But he said you don't run after money as an end in itself. And certainly when I was growing up, he taught me you've got to feel sorry for those people that are bragging about their fancy clothes or their big car. He said they've got off on the wrong track. And his great joy was nature. He was a naturalist, and he loved camping and hiking and fishing. And those are my first memories from childhood, are going fishing with my dad. And I've always been grateful to him that he really instilled that sense of the love of the outdoors. And my mother was this quiet person. You know, she was the backbone of the family, but she let my dad be the star in the family because he was an outgoing guy, and everybody loved my father. But my mother, you know, she was the first up in the morning and the last to go to bed at night, worked hard to keep the family going. And when I was a kid, I discovered a swamp. And this was an absolutely magical place. Whenever I had a chance, I'd jump on my bike and ride out to that swamp, and I'd come home covered in mud and soaking wet with jars filled with little wonders. My mother never once said, "David, don't come in here. You'll dirty the floor." She would welcome me in, and as she stripped my clothes off, she would marvel over all the little treasures that I had in my jars. You know, I remember when I brought some salamander eggs home, and boy, you would have thought I'd won a Nobel Prize, you know. "Oh, I've never seen salamander eggs. Isn't that wonderful? We'll be able to watch them grow and hatch." And my mother gave me, you know, just encouraged me so much to carry on with that love of nature. And I often see young parents in their spiffy homes, and a kid comes home with a jar of caterpillars or something, and right away the response is, "Take that out of here. Don't bring that in here." And we teach our children to be either frightened of nature or think that it's dirty or disgusting. And we begin that terrible separation between us and the natural world.
You know, it's interesting because I feel such a kinship with you, and quite honestly, my family was very much the same. My father, who always felt it was important to bring home enough to survive, but did not say we had to be wealthy people, and my mother, who absolutely loved nature. I just think that's interesting, and I think ultimately...
Are we brothers?
Well,
what's
yes.
What's going on here? We are both very lucky guys.
I totally agree with you,
yeah.
Because my father was sometimes pilloried for not being the guy who was going after all the big bucks.
Exactly. I remember, you know, we used to make a pilgrimage every weekend to go and see his mom and dad, and I hated them because they were always bawling my dad out. "What did you take that weekend and go fishing with David for? You should have been home working and making money." You know, like, they were dumping on my father, my great hero and my mentor. He was a wonderful guy.
Well, very similar. And then my mother, who just had such an appreciation. So I, too, was bringing home creatures all the time.
Yeah.
I had my little zoo and stuff.
Exactly.
But I want to move into that now because I was different. You were different in the sense that we somehow were drawn to those creatures. What can you tell me? Why? What was that fascination for you?
Well, E.O. Wilson, the great ecologist at Harvard University, says that is biophilia. Bio meaning life and philia meaning love. He believes that we all are born with biophilia, a love to be with other creatures. He thinks it's genetic. And that what we, and you know, if you take a young baby and show that baby a flower or a butterfly, or for that matter, a spider or a snake for the first time, you don't see the child recoil in fear. It always will reach out and want to touch it and
stuff it
in its mouth, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, they're attracted instantly by the movement and the color. That's what is built into us. I really agree with Wilson. I think we have just a natural love of or attraction to the natural world and other creatures. But what we do in a city is we teach them, "Don't touch that." You know, right away we're freaked out. It might sting you, or you know, you might be allergic to it, or it's going to dirty the floor. I mean, I'm amazed at the number of people I see freaked out when they see an ant on the floor. You'd think it was, you know, the filthiest creature in the world. I mean, we just teach our children biophobia. We teach them to fear or hate nature. And if you hate nature, then you won't hesitate to go out and clear cut it or dig it up or dam it or do whatever you want in the name of economics, and you won't have any sense of, oh my God, you know, what are we doing to that world that I love?
You know, it's interesting because I've been involved in environmental education in various ways, and what you just said gave me an insight, and that is the fact that environmental education right now, it's more dependent upon the parents for them to have an attitude, just like you stated, to be accepting of living life and as well to appreciating the diversity. Because if that doesn't happen, those kids will be precluded. They just will not have that opportunity.
Absolutely.
I think that's where we need to start educating people.
Absolutely. And I think you've pinpointed one of the real problems is that we've now had generations of people that have grown up in cities, in big cities. You know, when I was born, still most people lived in villages, rural village communities. But today, way over half of all of humanity in the world lives in big cities. We're a big urban dweller, and certainly in North America, over 85% of us now live in big cities. And it's easy to kind of lose that sense of love or feeling for nature. And we just continue to teach, you know, foist on our kids that flies and cockroaches and all these things we're fighting, you know, that we're teaching our kids that nature is an enemy to be fought. So the challenge now to reestablish that connection with nature is very, very hard. But, you know, what I've seen is programs to take children out. You know, you only have to take a child out to a farm, for heaven's sake.
Yes.
I'm amazed at the number of children that have never seen a live cow or a chicken and who don't understand that wieners and hamburgers are the muscles of an animal. You know, we need to take them out as young children, and it's very easy to connect them then.
Mm. I was very fortunate to grow up in the Midwest, in the farm community, and 1 week a year, I'd go out and spend a week on a farm, a rural farm in rural Wisconsin, and that's where everything began to change with the ancient old grandparents.
That should be mandatory, I think, for all kids in the cities, is to have that time at some point in their primary school experience to go out for a week and spend it out in the country somewhere, either on a farm or, you know, out in the wilderness somewhere in a camp. They've got to experience that.
This is actually fun because I had all sorts of concepts where this conversation would go, but I'm going to let it go where it goes because I have so much fun sharing ideas. I've often thought about a program that should be initiated called the Rural Urban Exchange Program, where families just swap kids.
Yep.
Just swap kids, because also the rural kids, they kind of hate growing up in the country too much.
Yep.
You know, and they need to get into the city.
Maybe. No, that's an excellent idea. I think we need as many. Well, I mean, farm experience, of course, is absolutely crucial. I found in cities, and I've done shows for children in cities, kids have no idea when you turn the water, the tap on, where does the water come from? Or when you turn the lights on, the electricity, or when you put the garbage on the curb or flush the toilet, where does it go? They have no idea. And food, my goodness, when you ask them, where does your food come from, they'll say right away, well, the supermarket. But many of them are shocked to learn that vegetables grow in the soil. You know, you mean this grows in the dirt? You know, and they're so used to everything being free of blemishes. They don't understand, you know, that, well, I remember when I was a boy, my mother would, in the fall, would sit with a big basket of apples or pears, and with a little knife, she would nick out all of the scabs on the surface, you know, or actually dig out a worm that was in the apple or the pear. I mean, we understood that other creatures were also trying to eat what we ate, and we didn't mind digging a caterpillar out of an apple before we ate it or bottled it or whatever. Now we demand absolute perfection. And of course, in demanding that absolute perfection, we get that by spraying massive amounts of chemicals onto those things. And I think for children to have the experience of actually seeing how their food grows in the soil and to realize that, you know, all these chemicals are sprayed on it and say, wait a minute, now I don't want that. I think that would be a wonderful experience. And to gather eggs from a chicken and to feed the pigs. And I remember Gretchen Daly, who's an ecologist at Stanford. she played basketball once a week with some guys, some pals around the university, and an engineer came out onto the basketball court one day and said, "Hey, guess what? I just learned milk comes from cows." He thought it was made in a factory, chemically added together to make milk. I mean, can you imagine somebody's 25 years old and doesn't realize that milk is a biological product?
It's incomprehensible.
It is incomprehensible. Yeah. And but that's the kind of people that we're growing up, people that sit in front of computers and learn everything out of the computer. You know, we need to see it, to feel it and taste it.
Well, and there's nothing like growing up and having a first experience as an urban kid, going into a dairy barn.
Yep.
And catching, you get up in the first thing in the morning, 5 o'clock in the morning, you're out there, it's cold, there's all sorts of different feelings, and then you walk into the barn and suddenly that reality hits you, the smells, the everything. That changes, that's a lot, that all by itself. Every kid should be forced to go into a dairy barn.
Absolutely. Because you're right up against, oh my God, I mean, this is stuff we're going to drink, and here's all this poop and pee and everything else. I mean, it's very biological. You know, one thing I've felt is that we're trying so hard now to get rid of the notion that we are animals.
Yes.
I gave a talk in Austin, Texas a few years ago, and there were a lot of children in the audience, and I said to them at the end of my speech, I said, "Now, kids, if there's one thing you remember from my talk, please remember that we are animals." And man, I couldn't believe how mad their parents got at me. "Don't call my daughter an animal. We're human beings." You know, we really think that we're somehow different. I mean, and you can see it in the way we use language. If you call someone a chicken or a pig or a snake or a worm or an ape, these are all insults because we think we're superior to those animals. But by forgetting that we are biological creatures, we forget that every bit of the food that we eat was once alive. There's nothing we eat for our food that wasn't once living, and most of it comes right out of the soil. And we forget that, you know, as biological beings, if we don't have clean air, we're in deep trouble, or clean water, or clean soil that gives us our food, or clean energy from the sun. You know, we've really got to get back to some basics, because human beings have become such a powerful creature now that our technology and our consumptive demand is really changing the planet in a very dangerous way.
And so we emerge in life onto our stage, into our moment. We continue with Dr. David Suzuki when your voice of the earth broadcasts the balance here on the Wild Side News.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
And then we continue on our journeys. Some seeking to balance their lives, others seeking to balance their checkbooks. Will some run willy-nilly onto the tarmac of tomorrow, hoping to launch and fly before the grand runway runs out? Dr. David Suzuki advocates for a natural order as his sacred breath derives from within the wonder. And so it has been, and so it will always be, as we continue with a man who speaks for many tongues. Listen. The things that we've been talking about right now are central to everything that you do and everything that you've done, and that is the fact that we must learn to integrate the fact that we are the air, we are the water, we are what we eat, we are
totally integrated and connected with the living systems. We need to integrate that concept much more deeply than it's possible to,
no,
based
I,
on
I
the
agree
modern
with you
era.
Completely. And I think, you know, in all of the environmental battles that are going on and that I've been involved with for over 40 years, the terrible thing is that when you have a battle, you know, you're going to try to stop clear-cutting this forest or stop this dam or stop the pollution. There's always a winner and a loser. And I don't think when it comes to the environment, we can afford to keep having losers. We've got to come up with some kind of fundamental agreement about what we're all about so that there is no such thing as a left-wing or right-wing or Democrat or Republican. I want all of us to understand what the really deep underlying roots of our existence are. And I try to illustrate what I think the challenge is in the following ways. I was 4 years old when I realized that I could actually read. My dad was taking me on a streetcar in Vancouver to a movie, and I suddenly shook his arm. I grabbed his sleeve and said, Dad, I can read that sign. And what the sign said, this is in 1940, the sign said, do not spit. In 1940, there were signs everywhere in Canada telling people not to spit. Now, cut ahead 65 years to the present. There are no signs anywhere in Canada saying do not spit. There are no spit police or fines for gobbing on in public places. We don't teach our children in kindergarten now, do not spit, that's not acceptable. And yet, in our country today, it's understood by everyone that spitting in public is not socially acceptable. It's just a part of what our culture is. But in terms of the environment, we're back in 1940. We still have to put up signs saying, do not litter, do not do this. Here's an area you can fish, but here you can't. We have not got to where we understand what our society is about. So I believe that we all have to understand we are biological creatures. We need, for our health and survival, we need clean air, clean water, clean soil that gives us our food, clean energy that comes from the sun, and other living creatures to cleanse the air, water, and soil. When everybody understands that, then it won't matter who we elect to office or who's in charge of companies. Everybody will say, hey, wait a minute, before we do that, we better check. What does that do to the air or the water or the soil? You know, you don't want to do anything to mess that up. Once we have that as our underlying deep-seated value, then we won't have to put up signs or tell people what to do because it will be automatic. And, you know, I'm always grateful that there are countries like Sweden. When the Swedish politicians are deciding on some new policy, they always ask the question, what is this going to do for our kids? Like, what are the implications out there in the world? We don't do that in North America. Politicians are concerned about the next election. They don't ask, you know, they're concerned about who's going to vote. They have to do something that will pay off to brag to the voters before the next election, look at what I've done. Well, guess what? Children don't vote. So children are not on the agenda in our political system. I mean, that's not because politicians are stupid or evil or bad. It's just that's what the political game is. When you're in politics, your concern is getting reelected, and the people that vote are the ones that are going to get you reelected. That's got to be your focus. So children don't enter the equation. Future generations, hell, they don't even exist. So why would they ever be on the agenda or on the plate of our politicians? So here you have a two-term president, and do you think that he's worried about his grandchildren or great-grandchildren? He doesn't even accept what the scientists have been telling him, that climate change is happening, and this is a greater threat than terrorism. And it's the greatest threat we face, other than all-out nuclear war. And your two-term president is denying that it's even real, let alone whether he should do anything. I think this is an absolutely terrifying situation. But that's because we're so short-sighted, and we listen to other lobby groups.
I'm a political junkie, and have been all of my life. But there's something that irritates me, and that is the power that we give to the politicians when the reality is the fact that the real power exists on the street and in the backyard. That's where the real power is. And we've given this phony sense of power, although they do have power.
That's what it is in theory in a democracy.
Right.
But when you have an election and 40% of the people vote, where the hell is the power there? And when that vote is so often determined by literally tens of millions of dollars in campaign financing, which is a massive amount of money to pour into phony baloney attack ads and all kinds of other things. Is this what a democracy is all about? A democracy depends on a responsible constituency where people are properly informed and take their responsibility of voting very seriously. And I don't think we have that in North America, not when 40% or 50% of people are voting and when the bulk of what they're getting from their candidates for office is all of this baloney ads, these expensive ads with 30-second sound bites. This isn't serious stuff anymore.
That's my point exactly, that it's just a facade. It's just a false sense of what really matters, and yet it does matter.
Well,
it does
what
matter,
does matter
but,
now is money.
Yes.
And the people that pay the money to a politician who's running for office, when that politician gets elected, they have direct access to that political office. So if you put millions of dollars into a political candidate and he or she is elected, you know damn well when you pick up the phone and say, I want to see you, you're going to see him right away. And that's the problem we face today, is the enormous amount, the cost of running for office, and most of that money now is coming from the corporate sector, and there's far too great power being exerted then by lobbyists representing the corporate sector. There should be campaign financing. We have it in Canada. I'm glad to say that the last Jean Chrétien, before he resigned, brought into play limits on how much money can go into any political candidate. I think it's a limit of $1,000 from corporations or private individuals. That goes a long way to about redressing the imbalance right now in the corporate influence.
See, this is where I think your life story, which is told so well in David Suzuki, it's a rich story, and particularly as it relates to your growing up and the pain that you suffered and the indignities and how that affected your, and now we're talking about real democracy, your commitment to coming to really serve indigenous peoples literally all around the world, where there is, again, in these little tiny isolated places in the Amazon, for example, where you spent real time, a very real on-the-ground democracy, and again, threatened in so many ways. But I want to move back now into that sense of your commitment to this, to the cultural diversity, because you've really put your life literally on the line.
But I feel I've been a student from and learned so much from them.
Hmm.
And it really, you know, for me, the opening of my eyes began in the late 1970s. Now, I'd been involved in the environmental movement ever since Rachel Carson published Silent Spring in 1962. And as an environmentalist, I always thought the problem was that human beings were taking too much stuff out of the environment and putting too much garbage and waste back into it. So the challenge was to regulate how much and what humans were allowed to remove from the earth and how much and what we were allowed to put back into it. And we needed laws and enforcement of those regulations. Well, by the early 1970s, I realized it won't work. It can't work that way because we don't know enough to regulate what we're doing. I mean, when DDT was found to kill insects, nobody had any idea that there was a phenomenon called biomagnification. You spray in very low concentrations out in the environment, and it gets amplified or concentrated at each level up the food chain. So by the time you get to the fatty tissue of women's breasts, or the shell glands of birds, you've concentrated DDT hundreds of thousands of times. I mean, we only discovered this phenomenon when eagles began to disappear and biologists tracked it down and discovered biomagnification. So how could we regulate DDT properly when we didn't even know about these things? CFC is the same thing. Nobody knew that they would end up affecting the ozone layer. So for me, it was a crisis. We have an environmental crisis, but we don't know enough to be able to manage our way around it. And for me, the big shift then was in the late 70s when I did a film on a battle over logging in northern British Columbia, and a group of Haida people, these are Native Americans, had been fighting the logging. Now, they had over 50% unemployment, and many of the loggers were Haida, and yet they were fighting against logging. And I said, this is really weird. Like, they need economic development. Why the hell would they be fighting a system that was giving them money, giving them jobs and putting money into their communities? And I said to one of the leaders in the fight, a Haida, I said, why are you fighting the logging? What difference does it make whether those forests disappear? And he said, yeah, if the trees disappear, we'll still be here. But he said, then we won't be Haida anymore. We'll just be like everybody else. And when he said it at the time, I didn't even know what the hell he was talking about till I got back to Vancouver and started thinking about it. And I realized, oh my God, these people don't see themselves as separate from the environment. The air, the water, the fish, the trees, all of that is what they feel make them Haida and different from everybody else. That for me was a huge insight when I realized, as environmentalists, we've framed the problem the wrong way. There is no environment out there, and we are here. We are the environment. They speak of the earth as our mother, and that's not metaphoric or poetic. They mean it literally because they say we are created out of the four sacred elements, earth, air, fire, and water. And as I began to look at this as a scientist, I realized, oh my God, they're absolutely right. I mean, if you think of air, you know, the moment every one of us was born, we take 2 to 3 liters of air deep into our lungs, and we filter whatever is in it. From the moment of our birth to the last gasp we take before we die, we breathe air 15 to 40 times a minute, and we don't even think about it. So think about that air. It goes into your lungs. Your lungs are filled with about 300 million alveoli. These are little capsules or cells that cling to a straw or bronchial, like straws. They're little, like little grapes clustered around a straw. And we have 300 million of these little clusters because we need all that surface area. If you flattened them out into 2 dimensions, they would cover a tennis court. That's how much surface you've got in these little grape-like structures in our lungs. So each of these cells or capsules is lined with a three-layered membrane called a surfactant. Surfactant reduces surface tension, so when the air comes into the lungs, it sticks, literally sticks to the surfactant. Carbon dioxide rushes out, oxygen rushes in, and red blood cells with hemoglobin pick up that oxygen, and each beat of your heart delivers oxygen to every part of our bodies. So the point I'm making is you can't draw a line that says the air ends here and I begin there. There is no line. It's in us, it's stuck to us, and it's circulating through our bodies. And when you breathe out, you don't breathe all the air out. Some of it stays in your lungs, and the lung and the air that does come out spreads around and goes from my nose up your nose eventually. We are air in the most profound way. When you look at it that way, then if I am air and you are air, and I jump in a car and drive 5 blocks instead of walking, that car is emitting all of its effluents into the air that is you and me. And it's pumped straight into our bodies. And if there are millions and millions of these cars and factories and all that pumping all of their effluents into the air, it's going straight into our bodies. I wonder if that's got to do with the 15% of North American kids now developing asthma. Maybe it's got something to do with that. I wonder if our own children have become the canaries in the coal mine. This is the way of thinking that comes when you recognize the wisdom inherent in Aboriginal knowledge. That is, that we are created out of these important elements of earth, air, fire, and water. And whatever you do to those, you do directly to ourselves. It's always makes me want to laugh and cry when I hear how we're treating our health problems is pouring more and more money into pharmaceutical industries. What's going on? We are the earth. We're created out of the earth. If we use the earth as a toxic garbage can, what the heck do we think is going to happen to us? Don't we think in the long run the health of human beings is a direct reflection of the health of Mother Earth. So clearly, if we're going to be healthy people, we've got to clean up the environment. We've got to clean up our mother. And that's what I've been learning from all of these communities all over the world. It's the same message over and over.
Time runs out eventually, sooner for some than others. And it's what we do with the time we have left that will be the legends of those yet to come. We conclude with a passionate warning. When your voice of the earth returns, here on the Wild Side News.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool block skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
During the 20th century, the changes wrought laid the foundation on which to build the 21st century. And if we use the past as an indication of things to come, it just may be we've drawn the wind out from under our dreams, and one wonders, as we should, where do we go from here? You're about to see the future, as only Dr. Suzuki knows how to describe it, when his voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News. And so we conclude, as Dr. Suzuki draws from a lifetime devoted to saving the soul of our Earth and talks about things to come. You've had the great opportunity to travel, particularly in your work with the David Suzuki Foundation, to very remote places on the planet and live with and share life with these people, which is an experience that...
An unbelievable privilege.
Yes, yeah. Indeed. And they have so much to teach us, and I am totally committed to this concept that they are just as rich and worthy in their knowledge as we are.
Well, they have knowledge that will never be duplicated by scientists because it's thousands and thousands of years old. Mm-hmm. And so every time we lose a native culture somewhere in the world, we lose a priceless body of information.
That's exactly
now, I have
right.
to tell you, most of the communities I work with in Canada are unbelievably troubled. I mean, they're dysfunctional. They have epidemics of asthma, alcoholism, violence, sex abuse, suicide. I mean, they've had over 150 years of occupation by a dominant culture that has told them they're nothing but savages. They have nothing to teach us, that what they have to do is quickly become like us and lose their knowledge and their language and their traditions. So no wonder they're completely screwed up. So I don't want to paint them as these, you know, noble savages that are running around living in this wonderful state. They are dysfunctional. They have unbelievable problems.
Which is actually a very important point to make at this point, and that is the fact that these levels of change have happened in our lifetimes.
Yes.
Our lifetimes.
Yeah.
Talking about the wonder that you experienced as a child, the work that you've done through the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, and these changes are coming so quickly and creating such levels of dysfunction, even out into those remote areas, but then not even to mention what is happening in our own larger societies where we're unaware, truly,
exactly.
of the scope of this. And that's where I guess, because unfortunately we only have so much time, we need to talk about the fact that one of the things that bothers me in some respects is the fact that well, it's wonderful that we're beginning to acknowledge the fact that global warming is significant, and it is. And the consequences of that they're going to be felt very soon. They're already being
felt. They are being felt. Mm-hmm.
And yet, the difficulty is the fact that if we overemphasize global warming, we forget about the fact that the oceans are dying, that the life, that we've overfished the oceans. In other words, we need now to really expand this out and make sure that in the process of focusing on that one, we don't overlook the reality, which is so complex.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, this is a question people are always asking me. Which is the most important environmental issue? Is it global warming, toxic pollution, disappearance of fishes in the oceans? Well, I mean, all of these things,
yeah.
We have no idea which is the one that's going to tip us over the edge. The global warming is, you know, the effect on the atmosphere is so immense. The repercussions are huge. I mean, the oceans are changing in large part because of global warming. You know, we have the largest sockeye salmon run in the world in the Fraser River. This year we had what was considered a large run of 15 million fish. But the great fear is that those fish won't make it to their spawning grounds because they're very temperature sensitive. And with global warming, the temperature of the Fraser River is getting higher and higher. So all of these things are interlinked. But I think the fundamental challenge is that the heart of the crisis is us. And it is the values that we cling to in our minds, our brains. We think that we are so smart and so important that we are in charge of everything and that the economy is the thing that must be kept growing at all costs and to hell with anything else. We are at the heart of the crisis, and yet we forget that we are biological creatures. And the absolute bottom line of the most important need we have is clean air, clean water, clean soil, clean energy, and biodiversity. If we don't have those things, we don't survive. So for God's sake, we've got to protect those things before anything else, and then ask, how do we have an economy and a society that can live in balance with those things? And when you look at it that way, the overriding need that we have is to realize the urgency. I like to say it's the equivalent of 1,000 Pearl Harbors going off at once. And that's the level of challenge. Now, I want to remind your listeners, I was a senior in college in 1957, just starting my last year. And when we were electrified to hear that the Soviet Union had launched Sputnik, nobody even knew there was a space program going. And in the months that followed, the United States failed over and over again. The rockets blew up on the launch pad again and again, or got off the ground and blew up. And meanwhile, the Soviets announced the first animal in space, Laika, dog, the first human in space, Yuri Gagarin, the first team of cosmonauts, the first woman. And we realized, oh my God, the Russians are really advanced in science, engineering, and mathematics. I didn't see the United States say, oh, they're way too advanced. It'll destroy our economy to try to catch up to them. No, there's no way we can do it. All I saw was, we got to win this one. We got to get to the moon first, and poured money into a space race. And look at what happened. Not only did you get the first people, the only people, to land on the moon, but all of the unexpected spin-offs of cell phones and instant global communication and CNN and all of the telecommunications, it all resulted as an unexpected side result of the space race. And look at this year, 50 years after Sputnik. The United States won every single science Nobel Prize this year. That's because the United States said, we've got no choice, we got to win this. And so it shocks me when I hear this administration saying, oh, well, we can't do anything about global warming, it'll destroy the economy. It's un-American to say that, for God's sake. The whole thing about the American enterprise is American entrepreneurship and the willingness to get up and go to tackle problems. After Pearl Harbor, the United States didn't roll over and say, the Japs have destroyed our Pacific Fleet. You knew, and the result was, you not only won the war, the economy was blazing white hot at the end of that. I mean, over and over again, the United States has shown what it's made of, and it's shocking to see that this critical juncture at this point, with global warming very real and very terrifying, that Americans aren't responding in the way they always had to a major crisis.
I think about these things all the time in a very serious way. This is, and you've already touched on this, but this to me is what needs to happen, because I know you like solutions. You don't want people to just talk about what's wrong. You want people to talk about how to get to a better world. I think, and you've hit on this, the concept of globalization is what is wrong. Globalization came out of a concept that if we all were one world and we were all kind of sharing things, and we had this similar economy and a similar sense of laws and things, somehow we would get along very well, and that's a good concept. The trouble is the fact that it all is based on, as you say, economics, as opposed to a different emphasis. And I think we have to really take a look, because this globalization process is driving things that are way beyond frightening when you start, as you are well aware, talking about China coming online, what's happening in India and the developing world, and the needs of all the people who are emerging who are going to want the goods, and it can't happen. Cannot happen.
Absolutely.
And it's based on the fact that everyone's supposed to have a job, and everybody's supposed to make money to buy all this stuff, and that's where the problem is. Something has to change. I don't have that answer right now, but I think we absolutely must, in the short-term future, begin to address this concept of economics versus globalization that deals with sustainability and human values and the survival of culture and nature itself.
You've opened a window on 5 hours of discussion, and we don't have time for that.
I understand.
But you're absolutely right on.
Well, talk about that. We have about 5 minutes left. I'm going to let you just give us a summary of where you feel we need to go from that.
Well, the problem, Hazel Henderson, who's a futurist that lives in Florida, says that conventional economics is a form of brain damage. And she's absolutely right. I realized a few years ago that I been going and giving lectures on the environment and spend most of the time talking about economics. I never took a course in economics. I just use common sense. So a few years ago, I said, I better learn to use some of the terms so that I sound impressive. I sound like I know what I'm talking about. I'm going to take a course in Economics 101. And because I was a professor, I could sign up for the course. And the first day I was going, I was kind of excited. I hadn't had a course in a while. And my wife said, Suzuki, as I was leaving, she said, Suzuki, why don't you try not saying anything for a change? Just listen, and maybe you'll learn something. Okay, I said, I'll listen. Well, halfway through the first lecture, the professor said, and now here's a slide of the economy. And it was impressive, arrows going back and forth, raw material, extraction, process, manufacture, wholesale, retail. And the idea is if you diagram the entire economy, then you can put a disincentive here or an incentive down here and keep the economy going. You can manage the economy. And I swore to my wife, I couldn't help it, my arm went up all by itself, and I found myself saying, excuse me, professor, where in that slide, in that diagram of the economy, where do you put the ozone layer? Where do you put the deep underground aquifers of fossil water? Where do you put topsoil or biodiversity? And you know what his answer was? The answer was, oh, those are externalities. In economics, an externality is something that isn't in the economy. So this is the lunacy of conventional economics.
Yeah.
They don't even consider the earth, which is what keeps us alive, a part of the economy. It's an externality. So this is absolutely a lunatic. Now, there are people that are trying to internalize what is an externality, asking how much would it cost, how much do all these services that nature is performing, like filtering our water, like taking carbon dioxide out of the air and putting oxygen back in it, none of those things register in our economy, right? So there are people that are trying to calculate how much is the value of those services. What would it cost us to do what nature is doing for us for nothing? And Bob Constanza, an ecological economist at University of Vermont, calculated a few years ago that nature does for us twice as much service as all of the collective annual GDPs of all the countries in the world. That is, if we had to do what nature is doing for us for nothing, it would cost us close to $40 trillion a year to duplicate that. And economists consider this an externality. It's not even included in the economy. And that's why Sir Nicholas Stern's study in Britain now about the cost of not doing anything with global warming is so important. What he's tried to do is say, wait a minute now, we've acted as if air is free and it has no consequences. Now, what happens if we carry on with business as usual, as the American corporate sector wants to do? It comes to more than the cost of World War I and World War II put together. Trillions and trillions of dollars to deal with the consequences. Now, you want to know what's ludicrous about this economic system. Economists think that the most important thing in the world is us, human beings. We're so smart. We're so creative and productive and inventive that they build the economy on human creativity and productivity. And since there's no limit to our creativity, they think there's no limit to the economy. So economists actually think the economy can grow forever, which it cannot. Not only do they think it can grow forever, they think it must grow forever. That if you just keep growing, and if we're not growing it, we're in deep trouble. And nobody ever asks, how much is enough? When you look at the level of wealth in this country and my country of Canada, it's obscene. It's absolutely obscene. And we still demand to have more and more and more, and all of that is coming out of the earth. Now, this simply can't continue on, the demand for steady growth. You can't do that, and yet it's the basis on which all of our business enterprises are built. I have a friend who started a company, a clothing company in Canada called Roots, very successful company. He's come to many of my lectures, and he said, you know, David, I agree with most of what you say, but you know, if I were to go to the bank and say to the banker, Roots has now captured 10% of the clothing market in Canada. I am a multimillionaire, which he is, and I don't need any more money. But I would like to get a bank loan. I want to stay at 10% of the market, but I need a bank loan to improve my factory. He said, the banker will not give me a loan. If I don't submit a blueprint or a plan showing I'm going to keep growing steadily, then they consider you dying. Now, steady growth forever is the creed of the cancer cell and of economists. And the end result, if we try to do that in both systems, is the same. It's death. So what kind of a crazy system do we have that demands and expects to have steady growth forever? When will Americans ever sit down and say, you know, we've got so much more of everything than when I was a kid. Am I that much happier? And I don't believe we are. Stuff is not what life is all about.
Unfortunately, it's what captivates us. It's a drug.
It's 70% of the American economy.
David, that's what I refer to as the nature industry. We need to start thinking of nature as the largest industry in the world and treat it that way. David Suzuki, I thank you so much, first of all, for we could go on for hours, as you say, and I hope in the future we do.
I say anytime. Give me a call.
If people want to find out more about the David Suzuki Foundation,
www.davidsuzuki.org.
David, thank you so much.
Good talking to you.
Dr. Suzuki is now 70 years young and thinks about his life and describes it in wondrous spirit in his newly released book, David Suzuki, The Autobiography, published by Greystone Books and available in bookstores everywhere. I want to thank David Suzuki as he brings meaning to my life as a naturalist and educator, advocate, and friend of the earth. Thanks, David. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again each Thursday or any time on the archives when your voice of the earth calls out. Here on the Wild Side News.